Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. My guest today is Will Jennings. Will is Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Southampton and co-founder of the Centre for Towns. Welcome, Will. So the focus for today is your recent excellent article, which you co-authored with Lawrence McKay and Jerry Stalker for the Political Quarterly, entitled The Politics of Levelling Up. And to dive straight in, I want to start by quoting the opening sentences from the abstract of the article and then get you to unpack that and get into more detail. So the sentence starts like this. Levelling up is an expression of a realignment in British politics, with the Conservatives presenting themselves as the new party of redistribution, full stop. Second sentence is, this is not primarily concerned with the redistribution between social classes or even between regions, but rather targets communities that feel they have lost their centrality and standing, end quote. So that's a great kind of opening line in terms of the positioning, levelling up and the politics of it in a broader sweep of things that are going on. Well, so just start there. Just say a little bit about how you see the realignment of British politics. I suppose, what is the realignment? And then we'll get into, I think, a really kind of interesting discussion you have in the paper about some of the factors that are explaining some of that realignment. So what's the realignment as you see it?
Well, I think what we're trying to do in the piece is step back from levelling up as a kind of technical agenda full of disparate parts, which we might talk about a little bit, and say, what does it tell us about what's going on in British politics? And I actually think to start with understanding levelling up, you need to understand it as an electoral project and an expression of electoral change, partly because actually, as you'll be well aware, the thinking around levelling up as a policy agenda is quite disparate and messy. There's not really a great deal of coherence. But what it does do is it reflects this shift of the Conservatives that have been doing over the last 30, 40 years, actually. It's not just something that happened with Brexit. It's been a steady change, have been doing better in smaller towns with aging populations that are less diverse, with lower graduates, and Labour has been doing better, piling up votes in major cities across the country, whether they're in the north or the south. And, you know, it's kind of linked to younger populations, more graduates, more young professionals, people who hold socially liberal values. And so one of the things that levelling up does, it takes that realignment and Boris Johnson's, you know, words the morning after being elected in December 2019 was about repaying the trust of people in forgotten towns. Now, and so in that regard, levelling up is a reflection both of that electoral shift that's seen the support for the two main political parties changing subtly. It's not, I think we can call it a realignment now, but it's not a complete realignment because the Conservatives still have support in the shires. There are still affluent people, many affluent people who vote for the Conservatives. There are still many people in deprived areas and, you know, working classes who vote for Labour, but there's definitely been a shift. And so what it has driven is this increased attention of the Conservative government under Boris Johnson, but again, it started under Theresa May a little bit, of trying to project a message that is that we hear the concerns, the disaffection of people in parts of the country that feel they have been neglected by Westminster over many years. And so that is, I think, at the heart of this the realignment that we've seen and has been, and it's been expressed in lots of different elections. Now, it's almost a truism to talk about the revolt of the places that don't matter. That's the kind of the Andre Rodriguez Poses idea. And I think there's certainly a lot to that electoral shift is really having consequences then in how the government's presenting itself and what it cares about.
And so I've got loads of questions just on that. But in the paper, you say, you know, very crudely, you can think about the shift, the realignment for the Conservatives, at least, being leftwards on the economic side and economy and sort of right side on, or towards the right on culture and identity issues. Just say a little bit more about that. And then I'm curious, because I know you study elections and, you know, whether the shifts that you've seen from the Conservative Labour have been deliberate strategies adopted by those parties or whether it's just been happenstance and we are where we are. But do the left-right issue first, because I think that's super interesting and helpful from the Conservatives. Yes, obviously leaves a question about where does that leave Labour? But I think that's a, you know, we can get to that as well.
Yeah, well, I'll try and touch on both. So, I mean, I think, so as regard the Conservatives, and I'm always careful not to completely stereotype this idea that the Conservatives are swung to the left on the economy, right? Because I think we're still, there's a lot of, you know, unknowns about actually where, what how their economic policy has really shifted because of COVID, actually, and the pandemic, that there's been such a massive shock. It's almost, we politics as usual has been suspended. But it certainly is true that there is a sense in which that post austerity, well, the kind of the austerity post-crisis economic policy that had been developed by George Osborne and David Cameron has kind of informed, you know, almost a decade of Conservative government thinking, has gone by the wayside under Boris Johnson towards a view that, you know, it's time to invest and to take the brakes off and spend some money across the country. And so one could argue that in that regard, you know, levelling up as an expression of the Conservatives are going to splash the cash in certain areas. Now, the words of caution I think we have to have around this is actually some of the sums that are involved in some of these towns fund, for example, levelling up fund, are actually not very large, bluntly, compared to, you know, other sorts of public investment. And whether the sort of return you get on them will be very substantial, actually, in terms of long-term economic change is quite up for question. But I think that there is a sense in which the Conservatives have moved leftwards, and their voters have definitely moved leftwards. In the book that we've just finished the manuscript for on the 2019 election with Rob Ford and Paul Osirish and Tim Bale, one of the things that we do and look in the analysis is look at where voters stand on the two issue dimensions of kind of cultural values and economics. And the average Conservative voter has moved to the left to where they have been previously. And so there is a sense in which on economic policy, the Conservatives are more comfortable with a slightly more expansive kind of economic offering, that those sorts of concerns about debt and so forth are somewhat reduced in salience. And in terms of being right on culture, again, it's easy to oversimplify the story, but there certainly is a sense, most of all exemplified by Brexit, that the policy agenda being pursued by the government is quite socially conservative on a number of issues, whether it's on, you know, kind of immigration, you know, the sort of Brexit it's looked for, and more broadly, some of the sorts of cultural fights they're picking around the war on woke, you know, some of the quite symbolic politics, which you might talk a little bit more about, very much emblematic of an agenda that is trying to appeal to a certain sort of voter who is concerned about, you know, changes, you know, traditional values, patriotism, you know, a mix of concerns about social change. And so that's the interesting combination that we've got with the Conservatives at the moment. And as you kind of talk about Labour a little bit, I mean, and that actually creates quite a lot of strategic challenges for Labour, which under Jeremy Corbyn really did have some problems dealing with that sort of social conservative message that, you know, actually is quite popular amongst a certain subsection of its base, certainly its traditional working class base in the north of England, who are actually quite socially conservative on many issues. Not, again, not all of them, but some of them, some of those communities are, certainly didn't embrace some of Jeremy Corbyn's sorts of messages, whether it's on foreign policy or so forth. As in any sort of party system where if you've got one party that's shifting left on the economy, that doesn't leave much space for Labour where to go. It can either go to the same sort of economic space as the Conservatives, or it can try and offer a more radical, you know, kind of policy solution, which has certain dangers because, again, as we saw in the 2019 election, if you have an economic policy offer that's seen as too radical, you can not trusted on the economy. And so that definitely, it definitely is true that what the Conservatives have done in the last 3 years, really, and you know, the two years under Boris Johnson, is really take a political space that's made it quite difficult for Labour to operate.
And that's why there is a sort of strand in the discourse around levelling up, which essentially ignores it, not ignores it, but, you know, significantly kind of downplays it as just a bit of frippery and a bit of wording. But actually, because of the context that you place it in, this realignment and some of the broader objectives, you take it quite seriously, and you argue that we should take it quite seriously because it's part of this repositioning or evolving position of the Conservative Party. And also, I get you to unpick it a little bit. You're talking a little bit around sort of three areas, I think, about how then levelling up helps that happen. And you talk a little bit about, you know, sort of public trust in politicians and the state. You talk about the fascinating survey work that you've looked at, or polling work on discontent by area particularly. and then just the very nature of the Conservatives inherently flexible. So just again, tell us about the, you know, the strange way in which we as the public view politicians and politics more generally, and how that allows people like Johnson to play into that kind of space. And then we'll take the discontent by area and flexibility on the Conservative sides in turn.
So I think, well, starting with Johnson, although it's sort of interlinked with trust. I mean, again, I think, and actually, I think there's a strand through the argument of the essay, which is partly that I think it's very easy for those of us who I see policy contradictions in what Levelling Up is about, or a lack of clarity, saying, how does this all fit together, to start seeing it as a pretty kind of rational project that is always going to kind of collapse under its own contradictions, because all this obviously hasn't thought through what it's doing, and therefore it's all going to fall apart, and people in these areas are going to see how they've been sold a dud. But actually, if you stand back and see this in terms of affect, about how people feel about politics and feel about representation, what you have in terms of the survey evidence we have is that the further away people are from London, the more they feel lower levels of trust in MPs, the more they feel that the government doesn't care about their area, whether or not that is true. And again, I think it's easy to get caught up in very simple stereotypes of government having done nothing for areas, when actually anyone who's followed this space for a long time knows that British government over many decades has tried in different ways to deal with regional inequalities, problems in cities, problems in towns, struggling towns. It's not like it hasn't tried to do these things, but they're really tricky problems. But in those areas, people feel, they feel low levels of trust, and they feel that government doesn't care about them. And again, you know, alongside that, Boris Johnson is very interesting as a politician, because again, those people like, you know, like us who follow say, well, he's been sacked for lying. The public don't think he's honest. But actually, on one level, the public, if you ask them, do you think Boris Johnson tells the truth, or, you know, is truthful, they say no. But then actually, people's expectations of politicians are really low. They think all politicians are liars. And so what they actually care about is sort of a certain degree of authenticity. And authenticity is one of these slippery sort of academic concepts that we all get. We all think we know what authenticity is, but none of us really do. But I think what he does do is present a version of the Conservative Party, which is not like the usual Conservative Party. And again, it's very peculiar. I think people who don't like Boris Johnson, they kind of, again, stand back and say, well, this is ridiculous. Here's an Eton, Oxford educated, you know, kind of toff, like speaking to the people of Hartlepool. How dare he deign to represent them? But again, it's actually, you know, it's a slightly reflective of our kind of our social culture, actually, that it's not just about class, and it's about he's able to speak in a quite disarming way to the people in those areas, that they think he sort of does care about them. And I actually think that low level of trust means they're not even necessarily expecting him to deliver and turn Hartlepool into a set of Pretz and, you know, Cafe Nero's, you know, and kind of, you know, kind of buzzing tech hubs and so forth. I think, again, it's easy to get caught up in these policy type circles where we all think, well, regeneration means like this, but actually a lot of it is about feeling like you're represented and you're cared about by, and just recognized by politicians. And he does seem to be able to communicate that in a way that other people, and certainly other people in the Conservative Party, have struggled to over the last few years.
Yeah, no, I think that is a great point. And I think one of the many great kind of insights I took from the essay was about the feeling that people feel they're ignored, and part of the response is to not ignore them, even if that is independent and different from whether you do anything about what the circumstances that they find themselves in. I think I found that, you know, that was one of the great insights. Just say a little bit more on the polling, because I found it, again, fascinating. So you're kind of looking at the sort of discontent that different places, or different people, but certainly different places had, when you ask them the question, you know, does the government care less about our place, I suppose, you know, compared to their place? Because there's, again, marked differences by different regions, right?
Yeah, and actually one of the fun things with this sort of survey is actually when you ask the question, I think probably does slightly sway things. So in the survey we did, which was at the end of December 2020, the area actually that had most people thinking government cares less about my area was Northern Ireland, right? When actually, if you've lived in Northern Ireland over the last 3 years, then it'd be quite very rational to think, actually, we are not central to what British government is doing. But their level of distrust of government not caring about them is just about as high as the North, right? Followed by Scotland, again, reflecting a particular aspect of that representation, but also Brexit, followed by Wales and the Midlands and London and the South, least of all. And actually, it's quite interesting that the South has the lowest level of number of people saying that government cares less about my area, which is 23% compared to 65% in the North of England, or really quite a substantial gap, but actually is less than London. And again, I think that's a little bit of a feature of our post-Brexit politics, which is actually that traditionally probably you'd have expected London to be to the lowest of all. But actually, one of the fun things that we've done with various surveys, when we ask this sort of question about how much government cares about my area, is actually that some now Remainers, the people who have been arguably the beneficiaries of the 20, 30 years of economic policy or the kind of economic model, now feel like they're not represented by politics, because to be fair, there has been a shift away from them. But there is a very deep geographical sense in which the further you are away from London, the more disaffected you are. And they're also similar sorts of, they're more subtle as well. I think, you can look at it at regional level, but even within regions, within kind of from peripheral to core areas, there are senses in which people in more peripheral to smaller towns, rural areas, feel they're not as cared about and have lower levels of trust in politics than people in kind of major cities. And so there is very much a kind of, within the UK, there's a kind of regional London and the rest story, and then a cities and outlying areas. And it's not just towns, it's rural areas as well. And I think that's a pattern. We're doing quite a little bit of research on that cross-nationally, and it's a pattern that we see in some countries with advanced industrial economies, but not all. So it's easy to generalize, but actually not everywhere has the same pattern. But Britain has a similar sort of experience. But actually, things like Brexit, but also actually Donald Trump in the US, can suddenly flip these things on their head, because it's about affect and feeling that the government cares about you and your area. When you do get these shocks that kind of tear up politics as usual, it can actually lead to some sort of a shift and realignment in how the public think about what government's doing for them.
It's a great point. Again, in the essay, you're sort of saying, levelling up is a classic example of the conservative sort of anti-ideology, pro-pragmatism. Only the conservatives could be what they were and then also be the party, not so in the near future, where they're dealing with issues or espousing issues around levelling up. I mean, just say something about that.
Well, I mean, there's so much to say, simply because, on one level, again, the kind of the idealist might say, well, this is that crazy. How can a party that was the party of Margaret Thatcher, which had such a pure ideological view of the market decides that, if Hartlepool is struggling, then, Norman Ted would say, get on your bike and go and look for work. And sorry, towns, but you've got to kind of shift to a party that is about economic engineering and saying that actually the economy should look different. And so on that level, it's absolutely remarkable that the party with that sort of vision, just, in recent times, that lived in the shadow of Margaret Thatcher's vision, has so adeptly and just quickly moved to a position where it's saying, actually, sorry, cities, sorry, the kind of previous economic model, we're going to redistribute to help, different sorts of regions and, the North of England, struggling, we're going to invest heavily. And so on that level, it's absolutely remarkable. But I think it also partly reflects the kind of the current Conservative Party, which is actually the kind of post-Thatcherite consensus, which is that there's really not been a lot of thinking around in kind of broad ideological terms. We do live in a slightly post-ideological age in Britain. I think the left kind of gets caught up in quite technocratic arguments around policy. And I think actually even, you could say Corbynism on one level was an ideological project, but sort of actually dealt with quite abstract and inaccessible concepts around, luxury communism, what it was going to call, those sorts of kind of slight idealistic views about society that are not actually very coherent. And the conservative policy doesn't really have, there's lots of post-liberalism type arguments, but you could argue that most of the policy shifts that we've seen have all been driven by electoral dynamics. Actually, that post-Brexit, there was a realization that, our electorate's changing and there's this bit of the electorate that's up for grabs. And everything has been done in retrospect because of that. But it does create certain sorts of long-term problems, which is, you know, for a political party, which in some ways Labour is going through the end of, and the Conservatives may be at the very start, which is, well, what on earth do we stand for? If levelling up is the sort of policy future for us, like how on earth do we reconcile that with the shires and with the suburban professionals that we once thought we represented, who now have a different set of values from us? And so on that level, it's a fascinating project because it's not quite clear where it's headed. It doesn't have a kind of ideological roadmap. I think with Thatcherism, you could see very clearly there was an ideological roadmap. And actually, you could argue that Margaret Thatcher was far more pragmatic than many of the people who succeeded her. I mean, she had the ideological vision, but was willing to compromise and make strategic decisions when it was necessary.
Yeah, no, quite. I want to come on to, because again, another great piece in the essays where you begin to unpack on the policy front what some of the inherent sort of tensions and or contradictions or dilemmas. We'll come to those because I think the five you identify are really interesting. Get you. So, you know, one of the criticisms that someone like I would say, but not, you know, that are interested in policy particularly, you know, we'd say, well, the problem is that, you know, it's not defined, it's very vague. It's not clear what it is that they're trying to achieve. I mean, in part, one of the things I took away from the essay is that, A, actually, from the government's point of view, that's quite a good thing. In a sense, the vagueness gives them a flexibility to respond to the ways that, you know, and respond to some of the things you've been talking about, but also that the expectation that some clarity will emerge eventually may also be misplaced from a policy point of view. So, I mean, it gets interested in your thoughts on that, whether, you know, vagueness is a virtue for the levelling up agenda. But also, we talked a little bit about it again, which is about the political value of levelling up, in a sense, you know, the ability to, you know, to steal some of the Labour's calls and repackage them as their own, you know, to focus on things that people are more inclined to, public investment, redistribution. So again, vagueness, is that deliberate and a good thing currently? And then the political value of levelling up, and then we'll come on to those sort of policy contradictions that you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, so I think on one level, vagueness may just be an accidental virtue for the government. It's not something that's been kind of inherently designed, but it's just been because it has evolved. I mean, on one level, it goes back to that realignment point. If levelling up was an expression of recognition among political elites that they need to change, it's almost naturally understandable that they then happen to a slightly incoherent position, which is, well, we need to do something about these places. Well, what are we going to do? And I think I can't see them wanting to, you know, put too much meat on the bones in terms of it being a hugely coherent agenda, because I actually think, again, partly on two sides of the coin, really. I mean, one, I can't see a scorecard type approach to levelling up being that helpful, because it is going to be a little bit fragmented. You know, I think we say in the paper, you can't give everywhere a big boost of, you know, do up every high street. You can't, you know, bring in a kind of a high tech employer into every area. You can't actually have a huge influx of young people into every small town, because that's just not how it works, right? And it's also because, you know, it's a bit like saying, you know, we want everywhere to be above average. Well, there are going to be some places where you have different sorts of strategy. And in my view, in policy terms, before we get on to come back to the politics, is that, you know, you need a policy that allows places to have a niche, and that recognizes and celebrates variety, reflects that some places might be kind of high tech type, you know, it's micro manufacturing places, some might be aging kind of nice places to live that aren't all about, you know, kind of high productivity growth, and that I think we probably we need more a message around that, and that's why arguably anything like a scorecard approach to marking levelling up is sort of crazy, because, you know, you can't, you know, you're not going to turn somewhere like Clacton into a young area, it's an aging area. What then the question should be, what can we do best for it to manage the outcomes? And again, a lot of as you know from some of the work you deal with Centre Cities, if you have a kind of a scorecard type approach, there's always going to be somewhere at the bottom. So again, you know, are we just moving the pieces on the jigsaw around a bit? And so that's why I think in that regard, you know, purely looking on kind of metrics is not the approach.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, again, I think earlier on in the piece you talk about how one might think about success of levelling up, and you talk as much about status and recognition and standing, I suppose, in the national sort of space, which talks to your point earlier on about places feeling ignored or not listened to as much as, you know, their things in their area don't work as effectively as they want. But then you go on to to talk about. So therefore, you can, you know, you can think about an approach which talks about examples and tokens and symbols of activity and success. And that's the way that you would do it through that too. I mean, again, I found that really, you know, which is a kind of a completely opposite view of, you know, a very rational, reasonable, laid out, comprehensive strategy with, you know, lots of different things going on, and it's all super structured. But actually, if you think about it as recognition and stateless, then actually symbolic intervention, some places, maybe not necessarily everywhere, but your next, as it were, becomes really important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's where, again, you know, that idea of actually having kind of small signature projects, which aren't necessarily in the wider scheme of government spending, a pretty small change, they do reflect what people, again, partly it's about how people experience their local areas, right? That if you can revive a high street, or you can provide some sort of, you know, small kind of cultural hub, right, actually does make quite a big difference to the way in which people talk about kind of see and kind of cognitively experience the area. And so I think that is a really important part of the story. Now, I think there are some interesting contradictions there. If the government is also serious about addressing things like social mobility, then, you know, those sorts of smaller projects where, you know, I think the Labour Party's just discovered this recently, actually, people quite like pork barrel politics, right? If you kind of say, I'm the person who's brought in a £25 million town fund to our area, and you're getting it because we've got a Conservative MP, the message people voters might get is not, oh, well, that's terrible, a pork barrel politics is horrible, which is actually, well, it's a good thing to have a Conservative MP because you might get a new swimming pool or something, right? And so again, for the left, actually throwing aside its sort of, you know, kind of high-mindedness of this is terrible, you know, non kind of perfectly designed rational policy is going to be important, because it is actually, it's a way of allocating resources that in other political systems is more common, that maybe it hasn't, because we've actually had such a centralized system, we haven't had that sort of, so much of that sort of pork barrel politics, or maybe it's...
Yeah. No, quite. I think, yeah, again, I think, you know, the purist in all of us sort of says pork barrel politics is terrible. But on the flip side, if you're one of the places that benefits from pork barrel politics, you're like, you know, well, you know, it seems to be fine to buy, you know, by my reckoning. I won't name the mayor that, you know, when I was talking to the mayor and I said, oh, this is all about displacement and this, you know, and he went, yes, of course it is, but what I'm trying to get is it displaced into my area, and then I'm the winner. So I was like, you carry on talking about displacement, young man, and I will carry on trying to win more than my fair share for my kind of place, which is, you know, which is from a constituency and political point of view makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that again is where, you know, a lot of people are quite comfortable on a local level with levelling up. It's something they can kind of relate to. On one level, you know, it's actually quite a pain for areas having to bid, right? You know, actually people who are on the ground, it does take time and resources. You need a certain amount of skills to bid for these things, and that's going to create policy problems. But I think on an electoral level, MPs will quite like it, because if they can at the right time say they've delivered the project for the town, that's going to be successful. Even if we say it's displacement in the sense it's not actually dealing with a lot of structural issues that we face as a country, that doesn't matter to the politics of it.
Yeah, no, quite. So let's turn to the policy contradictions part. You identify sort of five. I mean, they're kind of related to each other, and one feeds off the other. But in a sense, there are, you know, five sort of contradictions that you talk through. So let's just take each one in turn and just lay it out, and then you'd be interested on your thoughts as to where you think maybe the government gets to on these. So the first one is around, I suppose, the target. What's the problem that levelling up is meant to address? So away you go. What's the sort of contradictory element of the problem or the target as you express it?
Well, the first one always just in some ways makes me laugh, because when you hear people in Westminster, whether they're policymakers or media, talk about levelling up, there's this completely different set of narratives of what it's about. Some people will talk it's about productivity, right? And there are certain people who will be obsessed with productivity. Look at the output of different parts of the country. London's far more in the southeast are miles ahead. And it's all about regional. You know, so actually on one level, I think it's a slight wry amusement as someone who's been co-director of Centre for Towns, which is that it's a story which isn't about towns at all, which is about regions. And as you and I know, there is a very reasonable story to be made, which is about there are deep geographical regional inequalities in productivity in the UK that we should care about and we should address. And so there's that version, but then there's another version, which is it's actually all about towns, their relationship towards cities. You know, it's within regions there are these inequalities. And additionally, on top of that, there's, you know, there's the kind of is it about productivity or is it about social mobility? deprivation, economic, you know, other sorts of educational or economic outcomes. There's basically a whole set of indicators you could take. And so on that level, you know, when we're looking at leveling up in the context of it's about caring about areas, there's actually quite a lot of things you could care about. And again, you know, kind of harking back to an early point in the discussion, you know, productivity is not the answer for everywhere. And actually, you know, productivity reflects a certain sort of economic mix in areas which, with aging populations, you know, you're just going to have lower levels of productivity in certain sorts of places that are actually probably still quite good places to live, maybe don't necessarily have all the kind of assets and kind of services they need. But so I think that's the first contradiction, that no one's quite sure what it's about. And so there are bits of policy making that are kind of going, worrying away on the regional question, bits about struggling towns.
Exactly. And the obvious thing there would be, you know, if you, depending on which one you pick on as your problem, as it were, and you follow that through from a policy point of view, you would come to quite different conclusions, or you would come to a different policy script dependent upon. I think that's, and I think, you know, the points you make between within regions and between regions, again, is really a quite important point, particularly as it's often expressed as you say, which is a, on the one hand, a kind of London and the Southeast versus, you know, compared to everywhere else, but it's also compared to our kind of metro elite or big cities compared to towns, or it's an economics compared to a culture, or, you know, it's a productivity compared to a well-being. All of those are, there's elements of truth in all of that. Which ones you pick on and which ones you want to target, then the whole suite of options either expands, contracts, or varies. So yeah, I think that's certainly, my sense is, well, I'll be interested to see whether if they get anywhere near to nailing some colours to certain flags or masks on that target or problem issue, mate.
Well, I mean, I think we're waiting for the white paper in the autumn. I think that will start to
yeah.
I mean, maybe that takes us on to the second contradiction, which, as you say, they're all related. You know, it's actually a little bit about the theory of what connects places, right? And again, I think this speaks to the earlier point, which is, you know, it's bluntly about agglomeration, which is, I think, at the heart of all this is we have a certain agglomerative model of economic policy. And the question is, in some ways for me, like, what do we want to do with this? Is levelling up in any way engaging with that? And that's not to say that model has failed. Actually, in many ways, that model has been a great driver of economic growth. And the question is, well, what are you going to do about these different places that are struggling, and some of which are close to areas that have done better? Are we trying to connect them, you know, with centers of growth, or do we want to have places, you know, plow their own furrow, you know? And as you know, there are certain towns that are just so geographically distant from major cities that they're not going to suddenly turn into commuter dormitory towns. But actually, I think that the places that are in the outlying areas of major urban areas where the core of the city has done quite well, or at least not done as well as London the South, but it has been has seen some sorts of development. There is a question of, well, what do you do with those places? Do they then just become dormitories if everyone goes, you know, you improve the, you know, the public infrastructure into the kind of the core of economic activity, and you say, well, let's just not worry about the outflow of human capital in the daytime and what that does to a place? Or do you try and rebuild local economies and kind of encourage sorts of kind of small SMEs, small businesses, saying, well, actually, we want people to live where they work? And again, that answer's not clear, because, and those imply quite different sorts of economic policy. Now, on one level, you know, if you're just doing, you know, bits of projects to high streets and kind of sprucing them up a little bit and providing, you know, nice, you know, public gardens or whatever, that doesn't actually get to the problem. But I do think if levelling up is going to have some sort of economic coherence, it does need a story about, well, what do we do? What's the role of city regions and cities, for example, in relation to smaller towns? You know, if it is actually, which I don't think it is really, about really just kind of, you know, abandoning that model, then what are we going to do? And how are we going to approach different sorts of places? And if we are just focusing on smaller towns, then do we leave a subset of larger towns that are just ignored, which are actually many places that have been in kind of periods of quite sustained decline, and we don't do anything about those? And so I think that's the second contradiction, which is that we don't really have a theory of connectivity, what ties places to together, both in the daytime, in the kind of the workplace, and at night, and the kind of and outside the labour market. And I think that really is crucial for having some sort of policy theory about what.
Yeah, and do you think? And I agree with it. And do you think? I mean, Do you think when the Prime Minister said, I think he said something like live local and prosper, do you think he's sort of, is he getting at that, that the diversity of different perspective, well, different models, and we might need something for some places and something for somewhere else, and they're not mutually exclusive, but it also, they're not necessarily in contradiction. But it was interesting that he said that very deliberately, right? I mean, in a sense, there's politics to it, so we always get that. But do you think he's hinting at that when he says those kind of things?
Yeah, and to be honest, I think it's a sort of discourse that's been around in this area for a little while. And I think my fellow co-founder of Senator Towns, Lisa Nandy, said it on a few occasions about people not having to leave towns to go look for work. And I think Michael Gove picked it up after that. And so I think that is a certain story that's told about what is trying to be done. But again, I think actually, we need to see some meat on the bones as to whether it's just a nice, kind of rhetorical flourish that's very easy for someone who's demonstrating that they care about areas to say, whether it's actually, it matches up with the coherent policy, because it's complicated. I mean, on one level, as we've seen through the last year and a half with the pandemic, there is maybe more mobility and kind of flexibility to where people work and how they're related to their workplace that might allow people to live in more disconnected areas and just occasionally go into economic hubs. But you sort of need to address that in policy as to what you're building in terms of infrastructure. And that could be actually things like broadband, that, maybe if we think we're shifting towards a kind of a model, it's not just an economic model, it's a whole model of social economic life, where maybe people are going to do things from distance, communicate, then we need much greater emphasis on infrastructure in terms of digital.
Yeah, well, and that leads on to your third contradiction, doesn't it, which is the types of capital that we are primarily thinking about. And you say more what you think that third sort of policy contradiction and how that's played out thus far.
Well, so far what we've seen is just a lot of investment in, and a lot of investment. The most investment's been in physical capital, right? It's been in high streets, it's been commitments rather than actual building, but kind of physical infrastructure of transport and so forth, with a little bit, but actually, if you look at the challenges facing a lot of struggling towns, deprived towns, most of the core underlying issues are to do with essentially kind of much, not to do with physical infrastructure, though that is important. It's to do with education, skills, jobs, and often quite vicious cycles of deprivation, right, that you need to target. And so, there is a question with levelling up, is that how can you fix this if you don't target a really quite early kind of point in people's life cycle, where what kind of road they get on in terms of, we know there are deep geographical inequalities in terms of educational ability, social mobility. Obviously, a nice high street is nice for, certain residents of Hartlepool, but unless you're investing in terms of the social infrastructure, in terms of public services, education, skills, you're not going to make, really much of a dent in a lot of the deep geographical inequalities we face. Yeah. And so, again, further education is an area where, and apprenticeships, those sorts of things, I think are actually areas where there's quite a lot to be said for, moving the policy agenda forward. But again, that's all not going to matter if we're not actually targeting those places in terms of the challenges they face much earlier on. And so that's the other contradiction that, and it speaks to maybe what we'll talk a little bit more about, the spectacle politics, which is big physical infrastructure projects, kind of nice things where you can go and put a high-vis jacket on and a hard hat on and say, we've built this, boring social spending on dealing, kind of investing in communities isn't flashy, but really can make quite big long-term impacts.
Yeah, no, quite. When you were saying that, it reminded me when we did a podcast recently with Giles Wilkes, who'd written a piece about industrial strategy. His distinction there is between the visible and the invisible, and the road and the bridge and the tram and the train, the shiny building are all visible and therefore incredibly attractive to the politician, whereas the things are on skills and education and careers advice and support are invisible in many respects, and therefore don't warrant the time and commitment that they probably they definitely do. And I guess in a world if leveling up is as much about symbols and illustrations and tokens of change as well as rather than substantive change, you've got to inevitably lean into those kind of visible things at the expense possibly of the invisible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks to, you know, maybe the fourth contradiction, which is about kind of, you know, another emphasis on, is this about decentralization or centralization, which is, you know, it's very easy to send off a bunch of 500 civil servants to a new headquarters somewhere else in the country. But actually, the other dilemma is that a lot of, and this is true for many politicians in Westminster over many years, is a lot of politicians like to talk the talk on devolution, decentralizing, giving power to communities. But so far we've seen in terms of levelling up no evidence of a state, you know, the kind of Westminster state that wants to give any power away to people in communities, to regions, and is actually deeply uncomfortable with many of those things. And so again, you have that kind of mismatch between the political symbolism and the reality of governance. And again, that's where levelling up has just an inherent contradiction, which is, can we actually deliver, you know, a more even social economic set of outcomes regionally within regions if you don't decentralize power? And I'm highly skeptical of that, partly because actually, again, if you look at kind of city level, a lot of the advances we've seen over the last 20 years have been linked to political power and political representation, in, whether it's in Manchester or London. And so the thought that you can deliver much, you know, big change in outcomes without that sort of decentralization of power is really up for question.
Yeah, and it, again, it talks to the, you know, to the tension or the issue you raise in the essay about, it's about who's making the decisions as well as what the decisions that are being made are, you know, in the detailed sense. And actually part of it is at least the contradiction is exactly that. And actually, you know, some of the decisions by the Conservative government so far have been, you know, reaching into Scotland and into Wales to make some decisions on levelling up, which traditionally would have been a devolved matter, right? I mean, and you see those kind of things happening as well, which again raises the contradiction about where power is going to reside in, within the levelling up agenda. You know, more prosaically, we were promised a devolution white paper. Now that's been kind of rolled into a levelling up white paper. So it'll be interesting to see how the devolution strand, the power strand, how that plays out in the levelling up white paper.
I think actually, you know, again, how as that the complex current politics of the union at the moment, we haven't reflected very much on what that means for levelling up, but I do think it will have some consequences because the government is grappling with both this sense of it kind of a reflex that it knows it needs to sort of give some power away to deal with inequalities within regions, but actually also while not wanting to give too much away in terms of power to the kind of Scotland, certainly, and also even Wales, where, you know, it's not, the Conservatives aren't in power because it, you know, that uncomfortableness with devolved administrations. And so again, you know, that's a cross-cutting issue that makes levelling up, so, you know, also slightly incoherent in the sense that, you know, actually a government that was really concerned with levelling up would be trying to work out what it could do to support devolved administrations in Wales and Scotland, but they're of different parties and there are somewhat, you know, often at conflicts, as we've seen during the pandemic.
Yes, indeed. No, quite. And your fifth contradiction is about the money side of it and the size of state size. So just say a little bit about that contradiction.
Well, and I think this is going to become really apparent as we move forward post-pandemic. So, you know, on one level, as we spoke at the start, you know, levelling up is an expression of the shift and swing to the left of the Conservatives. But actually, at the root of all this is, you know, is levelling up reconcilable with the politics of austerity that has dominated the Conservative Party for, you know, the last 10 years, right? And its thinking. And I think that's true both looking backwards. So is it actually, you know, can you deliver levelling up while sticking to, you know, what, you know, most of the parliamentary party has believed for the last 10 years? You know, it's going to require quite a reversal on that front, but also actually post-pandemic, where it's pretty clear we're going to face, after the huge costs of the pandemic and getting through it, there'll be some quite serious questions about public finances. Is this sort of public investment actually sustainable, that the sort that is being promised? You know, and as we just were talking about, you know, related to kind of social investment, you know, can you actually invest in the social infrastructure of the nation when you've spent 10 years, you know, making really significant cuts to local government. And I think that's a huge question that at some point, you know, again, one doesn't need to be, you know, a kind of a very, you know, kind of new right economic thinker to think that at some point, you know, the public finances are going to be a little bit of a question as to how this all gets sustained. You know, does it end up getting watered down to, you know, kind of smaller and smaller signature policies, but nothing substantial. And I think that's the big dilemma, is actually whether a Conservative government can bring itself to expand the state, because that's what it will require. It will require a much bigger tax base, you know, to sustain that sort of public spending.
Absolutely right. And I think, interestingly, it's important within that sort of contradiction to distinguish between, you know, the level of expenditure we've seen over the last 12, 15 months as in response to COVID, but actually what that tells us about what will happen as after that doesn't tell us an awful lot, right? I mean, in some respects, you know, the austerity program that this country and other countries went through from 2010 onwards, that was 2 years after the recession. So, you know, it wasn't immediate, it was after the fact that it came in. So recognizing that, you know, what's gone on the last 12 months, you know, may tell us something, but it won't tell, you know, there's lots more to be played out, right, over the next 12 to 24 months.
Absolutely, and beyond. And I think one of the things that I find most bizarre about most of the commentary and our discussion about what's going on in British politics and society at the moment is just a lack of recognition that this has not been a normal period. This is a state doing completely abnormal things, which they had to do. I think they, you know, on one level, you could say the government was quick to move. It didn't take it too long, you know, although it was kind of helped there by, you know, broad economic consensus in terms of what needed to be done. But this is not the new normal in some senses. And what we're going to see is a whole set of real dilemmas that the government will face. And people will suddenly realize that the world they've been living through is not quite the one that they're going to be entering. And again, you know, I think the cautionary message for people on the left reading the essay would be that one shouldn't assume, just actually a little bit like after the global financial crisis, you can't assume that, oh, this is going to give rise to a belief that, oh, there'll be more social solidarity, that we'll care more about the people on the front line. You know, kind of years of experience tell us that it's not necessarily how people respond to major crises, especially as things kind of wash through. And so it's very difficult to know what post-pandemic politics will look like and what the state will look like as it starts to withdraw from all those areas of life, of kind of economic and social life that it's been intervening in. And that may actually take the Conservatives to quite uncomfortable positions as well. So, you know, on one level, it creates certain sorts of dilemmas for the left, but actually for the Conservatives, it will make, you know, sustaining this message, the rhetoric and the symbolism of we care about Yeru, we're doing things, quite difficult as we enter a much more tricky phase where some of the trade-offs and economic challenges really come into focus, and we'll move out of kind of short-term crisis responses.
Just final segment to get your thought on, because I thought very bravely towards the end of the essay, you pose the question, will levelling up be a success? And even, you know, very bravely, you hint at that you think it will. You know, at least in some regards, it will. And obviously, you explain why you say that. So, firstly, well done on being very brave and answering your own question, which people will come back to you in X numbers of years and go, so well, how do you feel about that? You'll either be lauded as being a prophet, or you'll be, you know, you'll be like, here's another prediction that can be consigned to the bin. But you do think at one level, maybe more on the politics than on the substantive economics, that it has a good chance of success. Why is that? Why do you think it's got a decent chance of success from a political strategy perspective?
In one regard, I think what we're trying to do, and I know more than any of the dangers of making political predictions, that I could be in three years, be shown to be completely off beam. But actually, I think it's really important to, I think that's what we're going to do in the article, was to make the argument that, you know, the left can't just assume that you just stand back and watch this thing fall apart and fail to deliver and people will turn to the alternative, because that's what happens in politics. And I say that despite being someone who's written a book called with Jane Green called The Politics of Competence, that actually the competence of delivering this may not matter. And so in that regard, I was talking to Jerry and Lawrence, I joked, there's a little bit of a cynical dark piece about, actually, because it is about the symbolism, right? And it is about the feeling. And so in that regard, if the Conservatives can deliver a policy agenda, a set of symbolic measures that show they're listening, that show they recognize there is something not quite right here, that may be enough, despite all the other contradictions that are associated with the agenda. And of course, I think it's partly due to do with structural features of the Conservatives are actually in quite a structurally strong position, partly due to the contradictions faced by Labour Party at the moment. And so in that regard, you could say, well, actually, you need to recognise that it doesn't need to succeed in policy terms. And those of us, like you and me, who spend a lot of time thinking about policy, might be, well, of course, this thing looks like a real mess. How are they going to kind of stitch it together? People like us, just by saying, oh, well, this hasn't really quite worked and delivered, because as we know, there have been years and decades of sets of policy interventions aimed at different sorts of geographical inequality that haven't delivered. That may just not matter in the final reckoning, that it may be more than enough for the Conservatives to be able to say, we tried, we're making an effort, vote for it, give us more time. And so in that regard, I actually don't think it's a very brave prediction given where we are in British politics. And if suddenly the public turned around and said, well, no, this is not what we were promised, I'm very happy to put my hand up and say I was wrong, but actually it's not, because I don't think voters get it. I think that it's just that it's important to recognize that voters operate on lots of different levels, one of which is a more emotional feeling and one is about a transactional relationship with the state. And certainly what we've seen over the last 5 years in British politics is that feeling of representation, feeling of status is actually quite important, as well as economic outcomes.
And because of the political forces and factors that you were outlining, well, you've outlined throughout, but you were laying out at the beginning, this idea of the differences between different parts of the country, or however you define them, which people like you and I have studied and known about for a very long time, and behind the scenes or at a much lower level or profile, governments of different persuasions have tried to do something about, some with a bit more success than others. But I wonder what your thought is, in a sense, this is the current government has essentially elevated levelling up or the recognition of the variation and the differences to almost the number one, domestic policy issue, except in obviously COVID, which is crisis management, and then obviously Brexit, which is of a slightly different nature. I wonder if you think, does that change the dynamics over time in terms of, because if you underdeliver on something that no one really knows much about, you can kind of get away with it. If you underdeliver on something you are talking about it all day, every day, does that, I'm grasping for, for optimism that substantive policy will have its
will
role
emerge. And there'll be some sort. But,
maybe it won't, then I'll just have to resign myself to that.
Well, I think the issue is that, on one level, it's, that ambiguity we talked about at the start, that actually it doesn't need to be a kind of coherent policy agenda with lots of nice scorecards ticked that the government needs to turn around in 3 years to say the kind of that new Labour type way of, the targets we've delivered, elect us again. It doesn't need to be that to say we're trying, we're working on this. And I think one of the things that's very interesting, I still think people are struggling to understand, and people like myself really haven't got fully to grips with, is by elevating this story about what's going on, it's actually quite a powerful rhetorical device about messaging, because it's both about we care, but also this other party, Labour, where it's with its support concentrated in cities among kind of university graduates, doesn't get people like you. It's actually quite a powerful reinforcing cultural message, which obviously the Labour at the moment under Keir Starmer is very clearly trying to address its vulnerability on that front. But it actually on one level has the power to become something of a self-fulfilling prophecy that actually that we are now, the Conservatives will keep saying we are now the Workers' Party or whatever, even if the survey data doesn't actually quite back that up, right? That their changing nature of their geographical support means they can keep telling this story about why they care for a different sort of voter. And I think that, I suppose, if you're looking for the hope, it is that whether or not, this agenda might lead to something better, is it ultimately whether it has to, it does eventually force the question of like, well, what are you actually going to do, right? You can't keep just doing symbolic politics for so long. But that for me is where, just as I said earlier, this absence of any kind of thinkers, on one level, I'm not looking for a Hayek, right, or a kind of Keynes, but it is sort of interesting, or a Giddens, right? It's like, where are the intellectual architects? And as those of us who kind of work look at kind of in the slightly lower down the kind of the food chain, the policy food chain, we're not necessarily providing the kind of coherent ideologies, right? But it does sort of beg the question, like, what is going to tie together the Conservative Party for the next 30, 40 years, right? Who's going to, you know, start to put that together a little bit? Maybe it's just going to muddle through as it often has done, but, you know, parties occasionally get little moments of kind of ideological clarity. And the same for the left is actually, you know, well, what is Labour's story about what it does? How does it combine the interests of, you know, of workers, of people in the labour market in towns and cities there, you know, with often with similar interests, right, as well as slightly different kind of outlooks. And so that, I think, is a really interesting space that Levelling Us Up takes us into, which is actually what on earth this means for the party. You know, what does it mean for the Conservative Party when actually a large number of MPs are from a different sort of background or different sorts of areas with different sorts of concerns, look very different like the Conservative Party of old? And I think that's where it's going to be fascinating going forward. Almost the next generation, like, who are the people who are going to be pushing through? Who's, you know, do that generation start to, you know, kind of dig their elbows in and start to take up quite significant positions in the party? And what do the old elite, whether it's not the grandees of yesteryear, but even the kind of contemporary party elite, think about that? Are they actually as comfortable with Levelling Up as a political project as they seem to be now, because it's very electorally successful?
Fantastic. A great way to finish. My brilliant guest today has been Will Jennings. Will, thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.